You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Last week was a week full of bad news, in a year full of horrors. But in the middle of that, I was privileged to experience an event of hope. Brown University is permitting students to make their case for divestment. Last week, they started making the case to an advisory body of faculty. This body makes recommendations on the ethics of investments to the administration. This body is called the Advisory Committee on University Resources Management, or ACRM for short. The bad news is this committee just makes recommendations. The good news is Brown students have a great track record of getting their divestment campaigns to succeed through university channels for both South Africa and Sudan previously. And this generation of student activists is determined, professional, and more prepared than ever to make their case. So today's show is the first of these ACRM hearings. It happened on September 4th, and the next is scheduled for September 9th. The hearings are 90 minutes, 30 minutes of student presentation, followed by an hour of Q&A. We're going to listen to the whole thing, with edits only for sound quality and vocal clarity. Because I want everyone to hear what these students are doing, but also how they are doing it and how their institution is respectfully handling their divestment demands. Now, it is a university hearing, so it is subdued and formal. But I found it very interesting, and I think you will too. Frankly, after months of abuse and chaos at universities, I found it truly enjoyable to hear 90 minutes of reasoned arguments, reasoned questions with a focus on decorum. And I do respect Brown for listening to the students, for putting their divestment requests through official channels to make it a formal recommendation. And we can all learn a lot from how the students are making their case and how that fits into one university's formal structures for considering student demands. We have a lot to listen to, so yalla bina, let's go. As always, there are a couple of notes before we start. First, there is a notification sound that goes off at intervals during the student presentation. I have no idea why. It's not intrusive, but it is there. The chair of ACRM is James Kellner. He is a senior lecturer in environment and society and a professor of ecology. You will hear him chime in to ask questions in the second half. You will hear students refer to a report from 2020 because Brown students have been working on divestment for Palestine for a very long time. They also mentioned the Watson Institute. This is at Brown and it's for the study of international and public affairs. Finally, to begin, it will start from student presenters introducing themselves. So with that, here are the students at Brown University presenting their case for divestment.
So we're going to start by doing introductions across the line just so you guys can familiarize yourselves with who we are. So we can start with Hisham.
Hello, my name is Hisham Aortani. I'm a senior at Brown. I study archaeology and mathematics.
Hi, my name is Nianta. I use the she, her series of pronouns, and I'm going into my senior year at Brown University concentrating in biomedical engineering and education studies. I'm the student body president.
Hi, my name is Abud Al-Ashhab. I'm a current senior at Brown University, concentrating in international public affairs and history.
Hi, my name is Anila Lopez-Marks. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a junior at Brown University, and I am studying environmental science and visual arts.
Hello, my name is Rafi Ash. I'm a junior at Brown University. I use he, they pronouns, and I study urban studies and mathematics, and I'm the treasurer of the Undergraduate Council of Students.
Hello, everyone. My name is Victoria Antimetti. I'm a graduate worker here at Brown, a fourth-year graduate candidate in applied math. I'm our vice president of the Graduate Labor Organization, and I just want to say thank you for all the students and the grads who are participants today and who are here in support of divestment.
So we want to start off by saying good evening, members of ACRM. We extend our gratitude first and foremost for being able to be here and have you listen and think with us today, and for the work that you continue to do in considering the ethical and moral implications of our critical edition of the original 2020 ACRM recommendation within the context of our Brown community and Brown's investments. We want to start off by grounding this presentation in what Professor Kellner had brought up earlier in the specific and important role of ACRM as is written in the ACRM charge. As we understand it, this committee is tasked with considering the following question. Does the investment or expenditure of Brown University resources contribute to social harm? If so, this committee relies on a two-pronged criteria. Either ACRM must believe that divestment would likely have a positive impact towards correcting the specified social harm, or ACRM may recommend divestment when the company in question contributes to social harm so grave that is inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university to invest funds. Although one of these two prongs is sufficient to recommend divestment, we will address both of them in our presentation today. First, we will outline the social harm perpetrated by the 10 companies in our report. Then we will demonstrate that this harm is inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university. Finally, we will defend the role of divestment as a moral action that will have real positive impact in correcting social harm carried out by these companies. These two prongs were initially addressed in the 2020 ACRP report 3 years ago. The previous report outlined three violations that justified an assessment of social harm in Palestine. The first being the building of settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The second being building of the separation wall through Palestinian land. And the third being collective punishment and home demolitions. In 2020, the social harm carried out by the Israeli occupation of Palestine was already deemed so grave and so inconsistent with our institution's goals and values that the committee recommended divestment. Since then, this harm to both our Brown community and the human environment has only increased. 40,000 Palestinians have been murdered by the Israeli Defense Forces since October, and that number continues to grow. I do not understand how we can see these injustices and fail to label them as grave social harm. So we will continue.
We have identified various forms of social harm, both previously from 2020 and currently, that have been labeled as grave social harms occurring in the occupied Palestinian territories, ranging from occupation and illegal settlement, as previously mentioned, to more recently apartheid and now genocide. So a brief overview. In 1967 and for the continuous 57 years, Israel has maintained partial to full military control and occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and now Gaza Strip. This type of occupation has been deemed by the highest international legal body, the International Court of Justice, as de facto annexation, and thus Israel bears the responsibility of the well-being of the Palestinian civil population, which is now over 5 million. Sadly, part of Israel's occupation has been the unlawful transfer of its own civil population to the West Bank, in which now there are near over 500,000 Israeli settlers living today. This has come at the immense social harm of the Palestinians, who are victim to hundreds of flying checkpoints, separation barriers, land seizures, and extrajudicial killings. Palestinians are experienced in their daily lives forms of social and harm and separation, most notably huge barriers that are formed solely within the Palestinian territory of the West Bank, known as the separation wall, to various barbed wire fences and security checkpoints, which separates not only Israeli settlements from Palestinian towns and villages, but from Palestinians and their own land and properties and own communities. I think it's important to know that we have identified, and other international organizations have identified, in companies such as AB Volvo and Motorola Solutions, which actually help Israel entrench its occupation and security system of racial separation, now identified by various Israeli human rights organizations and international ones as apartheid. What do I specifically mean by that? Well, Motorola Solutions helps and is a contractor of the Israeli biometric system for millions of Palestinians that determine where they can enter within Jerusalem and the state of Israel. If the committee is unaware, Palestinians in the West Bank, such as Hisham and I, must get a permit from the Israeli army to access the city of Jerusalem and various places within the state of Israel, something that Israeli civilians do not have to go through while entering the West Bank. AB Volvo also helps man and further support the hundreds of Israeli checkpoints, which at any moment can be used to shut down the lives of millions of Palestinians across the West Bank. I also would like to bring the attention that we are now currently within the 7th to almost 8th day now of intense Israeli military raids occurring across the West Bank, in which dozens have killed, let alone the 500 Palestinians who have been killed in 2023 and 2024 alone by the Israeli Defense Forces in the occupied West Bank. I think it's also, we'd also like to add that in addition to the previously identified social harms of occupation and illegal settlement, we'd like to add that now we are in the midst of an ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign in various parts of the West Bank, specifically the Jordan Valley. If you can see in this image, 12 Palestinian villages have been cleared out by both Israeli settlers under the guise of the Israeli Defense Forces, using companies that we have identified, have been able to allow Palestinians to be expelled from their homes, all while Israeli soldiers watch and separate the settlers who are burning these olive groves and properties from the Palestinians who are trying to preserve their own homes. This has also been identified by two Israeli organizations, B'Tselem and Peace Now, who have repeatedly stated from the reports that the Israeli government and military is complicit in aiding settlers in these acts of ethnic cleansing, as they have said. Most importantly, the head of security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the minister of security in Israel, has said, who is a settler in the West Bank in the city of Hebron, where I come from, that my right, the right of my wife and of my children to move around in Judea and Samaria, West Bank, is more important than the freedom of movements for the Arabs. This, in various instances, has enshrined Israel's occupation of the West Bank as apartheid. Now I want to turn to the egregious events and human rights violations that we have seen unfold in this past year. Since October of 2023, over 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed as a result of Israeli airstrikes and bombs, not to mention the tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians estimated to have succumbed to disease, thirst, famine, and hunger, according to various medical and human rights organizations. The International Court of Justice also affirmed in January that Israel is at risk and plausible risk of failing to uphold the Geneva Convention on Genocide Prevention by giving these staggering statistics and of the statements of various Israeli military and government officials showing genocidal intent. Also want to mention that diseases we once thought were left behind in the 20th century, like polio, have actually been resurrected in the Gaza Strip today as a result of the negligence of the Israeli army, intended negligence, and their prevention of letting in dire humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. My father has been a physician in the West Bank and Gaza Strip for over 25 years now, and has actually been denied access and entry into the Gaza Strip as a Palestinian resident, along with various ministers and doctors from the Palestinian Ministry of Health. I also want to mention about a new identified social harm, scholasticide. Since last year of 2023, there are no universities left standing in Gaza. The UN has reported that as of April 2024, that at least 60% of educational facilities, including 13 public libraries, have been damaged or destroyed. At least 625,000 students have no access to education, nor will they be returning to education this year and the next year, as outlined by the Ministry of Education. More than 5,479 students, 261 teachers, and 95 university professors have been killed in Gaza. I mainly connected this not just as a Palestinian, but as a proud student of Brown University. Think about how the number of dead Gazan students is more than half of our entire student body population. I can't help but draw the parallel of over half of my peers at Brown being murdered in broad daylight, and tens of thousands of more of my friends and family dying from disease and famine. At a higher education institution that is highly regarded around the world, such as Brown University, our actions and our practices are heard and said around the world, including in Palestine. I also want to remind people what ACRM's charter and values stand for. Brown has an obligation to prudently manage its business and investments operations to support and sustain the university's mission of teaching and research in the service of society within a community devoted to academic freedom and respect for human dignity. Now ask yourselves, is possibly being invested in an ongoing genocide and in an entrenched occupation and displacement of the Palestinian people promoting human dignity? Is it promoting the values of inclusion, equity, and justice that Brown University and its proud alumni and faculty and students claim to represent when they walk out of this hall and out of this institution?
Thank you, Abur.
In our correspondence with Professor Kellner and in ACRM's published correspondence with the Brown University community, we've been asked to present our argument in support of divestment from 10 specific companies described in the student-led Brown Divest Coalition proposal. We know that ACRM is not considering the question of operationalization today, but I want to emphasize that the screening procedure I'm going to outline is essential for understanding how these companies perpetrate social harm. In December 2019, ACRIT published a report which in part found that the occupation of Palestinian territory constituted a social harm and proposed 5 suggested criteria for identifying corporations for divestment. The criteria included companies that A, provide products or services that contribute to the maintenance of the Israeli military occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. B, provide products or services to the maintenance and expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. C, establish facilities or operations in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. D, provide products or services that contribute to the maintenance and construction of the separation wall. And E, provide products or services that contribute to violent acts against either Israeli or Palestinian civilians. In the July 2024 critical edition, we have formulated a screening procedure based on 3 company research resources: the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the American Friends Service Committee, a renowned global peace organization, and WHO Profits, an Israeli feminist organization, chosen to reflect a combination of international authority and boots-on-the-ground research. The American Friends Service Committee publishes original research, drawing on publicly available information and synthesizes perspectives from other groups. They have aided in initiatives supporting Jewish refugees during World War II and Japanese internment camp survivors, and in initiatives opposing apartheid in South Africa. WHO Profits conducts original investigative research on corporate involvement in the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights conducted original investigative research reviewing corporate involvement in settlement expansion. The research conducted by these internationally recognized screening databases informed the selection of 10 companies as particularly egregious offenders to be explicitly named as violating 2 or more criteria for identifying corporations for divestment, as listed in the 2020 ACRIT report: Northrop Grumman, RTX Corporation, formerly Raytheon, Airbus, Volvo, Boeing, General Dynamics, General Electric, Motorola Solutions, Textron, and Safariland. I'm happy to speak more in depth about each of the 10 companies during the Q&A section of this meeting, but in the following section, I'm going to focus on 3 of the 10 in our proposal and their specific violations of ACRIP's criteria, determined by their role in the distribution and manufacturing of surveillance systems, weapons, and other machinery used to maintain Israeli settlements. General Dynamics has consistently supplied the Israeli military with weapons that have been used to maintain their occupation of Gaza and the West Bank and have contributed to violent acts against Palestinian civilians. This violates ACRIP criteria A and E, with the production and distribution of aircrafts, bombs, and tanks used to monitor enemy activities, target civilians, homes, and refugee camps, and contribute to major assaults in Gaza. Equipment manufactured by Volvo Group supports the Israeli settlement industry, IDF military activities, and military checkpoints and walls that separate Palestinians from Israelis. This violates ACRIP criteria for divestment A, B, and D by supplying machinery, including wheel loaders and truck excavators, used to destroy Palestinian infrastructure, including homes, roads, agricultural walls, and wells. Motorola provides technology to maintain illegal settlements and the separation wall. They are the sole supplier of the Israeli military's encrypted communications network and provide Moto Eagle and Motorola surveillance systems, violating criteria A, B, and D. I'd now like to pass the mic to Hisham, who's going to speak to what these social harms look like on the ground.
Of course, it is easy to talk of legalistic terms such as apartheid, which require specific criteria and to look at criteria as we have before, but that often conceals the real lived day-to-day experience, which often make up the actions described by these terms. What does it really mean to be invested in one of these companies? Well, if we look at General Dynamics, what does it mean to be invested in that company? It means that there are many students here at Brown who have lost family members in Gaza. There are many people who I know who've lost their homes. They've lost everything. Some have lost limbs. It means that we are invested in that process, that we are rubber stamping the dropping of bombs on Gaza. What does it mean to be invested in Volvo or Motorola? It doesn't mean that you're invested in a company that produces, you know, Swedish cars or flip phones. Rather, you have to look at what else these companies do. And in the case of these two companies, it is a deep involvement in the apartheid going on the West Bank. For instance, Volvo is heavily invested in the settler complex, which is one of the most egregious parts of human rights violations and apartheid in the West Bank. This means that when my family go from Ramallah, where we live, to our home village of Anabta, and settlers throw rocks at our car, and the Israeli armies defends those settlers, it means that we are taking the stance of the people throwing the rocks at our car. It means when we go to Abud's hometown of Hebron and see cameras there, the cameras are not there for our protection. They're there for the protection of settlers. That means we are taking the side of settlers and against international law. That means whenever Palestinians have to go through checkpoints which limit their movement and humiliate them on a daily basis, that means we are on the side of the people restricting movement and going against basic human rights and the right to dignity. Therefore, investment is not just an abstract financial decision. Investment is an active decision.
Now that Hisham has spoken about the ways in which the products manufactured by Motorola, Volvo, General Dynamics, and all of the 10 companies listed in our report facilitate day-to-day harm in Palestine amidst ongoing genocide, apartheid, and scholasticide, let's address how this relates to the first prong of Akram's test, which describes social harm so grave that it would be inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university to invest funds. In order to assess this criteria, we need to understand what exactly these goals and principles are. So, what are our university's values? First, let's examine Brown's de facto mission and values. Our university's mission statement proclaims our duty to serve the community, the nation, and the world. How can we reconcile our obligation to serve the global community with the ongoing scholasticide in Gaza? The Watson Institute seeks to promote a just and peaceful world. How can we advocate for that when our current investment policy allows us to maintain a financial stake in companies profiting off of documented human rights abuses and plausible genocide in Gaza? As incoming first years, every single one of us is tasked with reading Brown's Slavery and Justice report. Given the university's historical complicity in the slave trade, the report emphasizes the university's special obligation to ensure that it does not profit from any forms of gross injustice. How can we espouse this mission when these 10 companies are actively facilitating and profiting from the institution of apartheid in occupied Palestinian territories? These values are all explicitly entrenched in our university's stated goals and principles. And we argue that the social harm perpetrated by the companies that our screening procedure has identified is entirely antithetical to these values.
And in addition to the values that Anila just highlighted, that are explicitly in the mission statements, Brown University's values are defined by the values of our community. What are our goals and principles? What are our values? If not the values of our undergraduates, our graduate students, our alumni, our faculty members, those of you who sit on this board. And time again, our community has demonstrated that our values are inconsistent with the investment in the companies identified by our screening procedure. I came to this institution, chose to attend this school precisely because I believe and want to believe in its mission and values, and believe these values are strongly upheld by the community that exists here. In the spirit of academic freedom, we will always have discourse and disagreement, but the methods to assess the democratic opinion have all shown a majority in favor of divestment. President Paxson frequently argues that divestment is not an appropriate response to issues on which members of our community disagree. We believe that disagreement cannot be a justification for inaction. There will always be disagreement, but it cannot be an excuse to ignore the overwhelming, consistent demonstration of our community values. Our community has demonstrated the inconsistency between our principles and these investments through our votes. A 2019 UCS referendum showed 69% of respondents in favor of divestment. In 2021, a graduate student council referendum showed 87% in favor. More recently, a 2024 Brown Daily Herald poll found 67% in favor. fact that I'm sitting here in front of you guys as a student body president that ran on a platform of divestment shows another majority. And our community has also demonstrated these deeply held convictions and principles through their actions. Through two sit-ins in which students were arrested as they peacefully expressed their desire for Brown University to divest. Through a hunger strike in which more than 200 students participated in solidarity, asking again for their values to be considered. Through an encampment where students refused to allow the university to continue to ignore these values. Of course, we acknowledge that this is a contested issue. Of course, there is disagreement. ACRM's charge asks today if investment in these companies is so grave as to be inconsistent with the university's goals and principles. Without equivocation, Brown's investment in the Israeli occupation of Gaza violate the university's goals and principles. When Brown University's stated principles are in such direct contradiction to the overwhelmingly evident social harm being perpetrated in Gaza, and when our community members who embody and define these principles have demonstrated this contradiction time and time again, we feel the answer to this question can be nothing other than a resounding yes.
Demonstrating that the social harm being perpetrated is inconsistent with the university's principles is already sufficient to recommend divestment. But we would like to address the other prong as well, the actual efficacy of divestment in addressing the social harm. We all understand that the impact of divestment actions by universities like Brown, at least initially, are primarily symbolic. Indeed, the Campus Committee on South Africa wrote in 1987, "It is apparent to all of us that a far more important impact of divestment than its direct economic effects is its indirect communication of our seriousness of purpose to the U.S. government." Likewise, President Simmons described the 2006 decision to divest from Sudan as a critically important and strong statement by the university community. However, both South Africa and Sudan should remind us of the real power U.S. universities, particularly elite ones like Brown, have to influence government policy in ways that can materially change the situation on the ground in Palestine. While Brown was a relative latecomer to divesting from South Africa, partially divesting in February 1986, whereas peer institutions like Columbia had divested as early as 1985, divestment actions at institutions like Brown played a crucial role in changing the wider national conversation about South Africa. Actions by Columbia, Brown, and other universities and institutions culminated in Congress, passing the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act in October 1986. In the case of Sudan, Brown took the lead as the sixth university in the nation to take a divestment action. 61 universities followed suit. And 2 years later, Congress passed the Sudan Accountability and Divestment Act. We believe today, divestment retains its role as a potent action for three main reasons. One, it is perceived as putting our money where our mouth is. Rather than empty rhetoric, we make it clear we are willing to make sacrifices as a community, foregoing future potentially lucrative investments in order to stand for our values. Two, it places present calls for an end to the suffering in Gaza into a proud civic tradition of successful nonviolent movements for peace and justice at American universities, and at Brown University in particular, where ACRM and its predecessors have played an active role in facilitating social change. Three, endowment policies and ACRM's charge are uniquely appropriate places for the university community to make decisions about investment ethics in a deliberative and democratic manner while respecting the rights to free speech and academic freedom enjoyed by all members of the community. As a resource whose management reflects the entire university community as opposed to individual opinions, there is no such thing as a neutral investment policy. Either Brown reserves the right to invest in companies that profit from the deaths of Israeli and Palestinian civilians, or it does not. In either case, there are certain members of our community who will find that decision deeply distressing, and it is their responsibility to use their protected free speech rights and established university deliberative processes to convince others of their reasons for how they believe the endowment should be invested. Since our initial divestment proposal in 2012, our community has been hard at work grappling with the present question of Palestine. We have spent more than a decade participating in discussions, debates, classes, teach-ins, referenda, petitions, and committee deliberations. And time again, a clear consensus has emerged. Divestment from companies profiting from the Israeli state's apartheid and genocide is a moral obligation for our community. from the alumni who have signed petitions in a 2-to-1 margin in favor of divestment, to undergrads and grads voting in supermajority referendums, to hundreds of faculty and staff signing various statements in support. It is clear where our community stands. We fundamentally believe in the efficacy of divestment as a means of influencing public moral stances and policy. As Frank Licht wrote, in favor of the corporation divesting from apartheid South Africa, Brown is a powerful institution. What it has to say is heard in the office of the President of the United States and in the halls of Congress. What we have to say is heard among all the colleges and universities of the United States, and what we have to say is heard in South Africa. Unwillingness to yield, unwillingness to take a lead, willingness to follow those who are tentative and timid, these are not the ways to solve this brutal problem. To conclude, I would be remiss not to acknowledge the national media narrative that pits divestment actions against the safety of Jewish students. As a Jewish student, amongst a critical mass of hundreds of Jewish students here on my campus, my peers and I believe strongly enough in the promise of divestment that we have risked arrest, hunger, and academic consequences to fight for this proposal to come to a vote. Why? We do it because we are friends, partners, peers, and students of Palestinian members of our community, whose safety and security we care about deeply, as their well-being contributes to our well-being and vice versa. But we also fight for divestment because we have looked at 2 millennia of Jewish history and observed that Jewish safety and cultural flourishing occurs best under conditions of multi-ethnic, multi-religious coexistence. Our divestment proposal does not choose between justice for Jewish and Palestinian people. It is a commitment to freedom and equality for all people, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. While we come from a range of political orientations and religious practices, we all believe that states committed to equal rights and equal access to resources for all people under its jurisdiction are the best way to ensure sustainable Jewish flourishing here in America, in Israel, Palestine, and across the globe. Apartheid, genocide, scholasticide are not Jewish values. In fact, they are antithetical to Jewish values, just as they are fundamentally inconsistent with Brown University's principles and values. We are all here because we love our university and truly believe in its the ideals it is founded on. We are here because we believe in the unique power ACRM has in aligning our university's endowments practices with these ideals. By implementing this screening procedure, we can ensure that going forward, our university can actually embody the values we all share of peace, of service to the global community, and of not profiting off of gross injustice. In 2020, ACRP recognized the severity of the social harm perpetrated by companies facilitating the Israeli occupation. In light of the devastating increase in social harm in the years since, we believe it is ACRM's obligation to reaffirm the work of its predecessor and continue its legacy in spearheading the democratic processes that yield meaningful social change. Divestment is an opportunity for Brown to demonstrate moral leadership at a pivotal historical juncture. If Brown does not take a stand now against that horrific violence unfolding in Palestine, what does Brown stand for? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. We're going to start now with questions from the committee. I'm going to begin. I want to reemphasize what we discussed before the meeting. You shouldn't interpret the lack of a question as agreement. You shouldn't interpret the presence of a question or disagreement. Our job is to get to the bottom of the assumptions that underpin your argument. Okay. So my first question to you is about, there's going to be a series of questions, I think, about social harm. The social harm you're describing is social harm that exists in the world. The social harm that we are tasked with considering is the social harm that is caused by Brown University's actions. I'm sure you're aware, because the information is publicly known, that Brown University has no direct investments in any of these 10 companies. There is very likely to be some degree of exposure in what we consider to be indirect investments. These are funds that the university invests in that may themselves have some exposure. I've checked. The number I've been given is that it's probably under about 1% exposure to these companies within the upper 80% of the university's endowment that is invested in that way. So one reaction to your request is that there isn't anything to divest from. And I'd like to ask you to speak to that question. And I'd like to ask you to help us think through the degree to which Brown University's actions are causally linked to the social harms that you've identified.
Yes, I'm happy to take this question. First, I'd like to acknowledge we do know that we're not invested in through our direct investments. And we also recognize that the large majority of Brown's endowment is invested in indirect investments. But what we do know is, first, the case that we outlined at the later part of our presentation, which is that divestment is in and of itself a principled and moral stance. When we ask the question of social harm in particular, we also ask the question of future investments at Brown. When we ask the question of divestment, we have to sit here and consider where our institution's resources will be invested 5 years from now, 10 years from now, going forward. When we talk about complicity and we talk about social harm, this process protects us from future potential investments in these companies and in this social harm. And as we have talked through today, there is clear proven social harm that we have listed and proven and shown in these companies. And so to not protect ourselves from potentially in the future investing in these companies is also a serious social harm. And we consider that a social harm in and of itself.
So your answer is essentially you're distinguishing between existing situations that are happening now as a result of Brown University investment action and then the potential future. And you're talking about the putting in place of what one might consider to be guardrails that prevent future investment in companies that currently profit from the kinds of social harms that you are describing today. Is that right?
Yes, but we also talk about Brown's role as an institution that has a public position in determining moral and principled behaviors. And when we talk about the direct potential for social influence, our divestment policies have an impact.
I may add to that. As we mentioned before, a large part of Brown's investment is managed through third-party fund managers. And in the past, when Brown has divested from companies, specifically Sudan and also tobacco, it has been less of a direct divestment from specific companies, is more of like sitting guidelines with these third-party managers as, you know, what Brown is willing to have their money in. And so our argument here in a wider sense is that Brown should, you know, should communicate with these third-party investors in order to set guidelines about what Brown is willing to have its money invested in, and that it's not willing to have its money invested in companies that engage in gross human rights violations, specifically in the West Bank and Gaza.
I want to come back to something that was just said a moment ago. You were talking about the companies causing social harm. And implicit in that idea is the position that companies are responsible for the way their products are used, right? So let's talk about alcohol manufacturers, for example, which are alcohols, I think, widely enjoyed, in, at least in this country. It's widely enjoyed around the world. It contributes to all kinds of social harm. It contributes to domestic violence. It contributes to mortality, drunk driving accidents. It contributes to morbidity and disease. One could say that that is a clear social harm, right? But we're not talking about divesting from alcohol manufacturers or distributors or the people who facilitate the consumption of alcohol. And I'm wondering if you could comment on how you'd have us think about this. I'm using alcohol simply as an example. I'm talking about the possibility that one could identify social harm broadly across many different kinds of things that could leave the university in a situation where it's just kind of isolated in the world and unable to meet some of its other obligations, which require the investment of its resources. How do you respond to that?
I think I can take that in some capacity. I'd like to contextualize this too in the fact that we are here talking about, I understand your example of alcohol, but we're talking about a situation that directly pertains to two Palestinians who are sitting in the room with us, right? This is a very personal, deeply personal thing for a lot of students on this campus. As someone who's sitting here and was elected on a pro-divestment platform, people have come to me talking about how deeply of a personal thing this is. When we're talking about the potential social harm that comes from refusing to make a statement as well, that is something that would contribute to our community as a whole. Right now, we're talking directly about students here who are seeing Brown's lack of a commitment to standing against things that they've stood against in the past when it came to the case of Sudan and South Africa. In the past, we have stood against things such as apartheid and genocide. And for this to be an exception to that legacy that Brown has taken on is a direct contradiction to a large majority of students that have expressed that we want a commitment to that moving forward. Like we said, we are here in the spirit of academic freedom and inquiry. And if someone would like to come and establish those social harms and establish those majorities and community values that are in line with, let's say, something like alcohol, that is something we would welcome. If that is something that results in community dialogue and results in these majority opinions and come forward to a board like ACRM and can present that case in an effective manner, we welcome that. But I think right now what we're talking about is the fact that this is directly influencing a lot of people on our campus, and a lack of a commitment to divestment is saying as much as continuing to say that we will refuse to make a statement moving forward that we are not committed to contributing to companies that are perpetrating harm like this.
Companies such as Motorola Solutions actually, when their engagement in the occupied territories, do actually have a say in how their products are being used, because Motorola Solutions, for example, 2020, had made specific programs to provide eSIMs to the Israeli army and Israeli military personnel. Companies like such as Safariland actually advertise that some of their gas canisters have been tested, and their test grounds are the occupied Palestinian territories. Some of these companies, and especially, for instance, like Who Profits, have shown that companies actually are consenting when they operate in the occupied territories, that they kind of become a test lab for occupation in immobility, promoting the immobility of Palestinians and overall promoting occupation and settlement expansion. A great example is when Ben & Jerry's pulled out and divested from the Israeli occupied territories. They said that they will no longer have their products, or that they will choose to profit from their products being sold in the occupied territories in Israeli settlements. So very much companies do kind of have a say, especially the ones like Motorola, for instance, and how their products are actually being managed and used by the Israeli state and government.
Just to speak to the efficacy as well, I think a hope that we have is that a yes to divestment will also be a message to these companies that we are not in support of the ways that you violated these criteria. If you no longer violate them, we can invest in, you know, the work that you do. And so I think it's kind of pertinent to both of the questions that you were asking. We think that this could be a sign to Motorola, to all these companies. If you are able to change this, if you also divest from that and change the way that you're, you know, behaving so you no longer violate the criteria, then we can consider again, then the managers can consider again. The criteria would no longer be violated. So I just wanted to kind of tie it with the previous question.
Thank you.
The final thing that I would acknowledge is, one, while we do recognize the, you know, potential social harms that could be proved by a substance like alcohol, and in fact, tobacco is something that Brown University has divested from, this conversation today is grounded in a social harm that is so grave it is internationally recognized in apartheid, in genocide, in scholasticide. And that is what has inspired this level of student action, community action within the Brown community and within the student national movement. And, you know, we can have the conversation, as Neonta said, about alcohol, if that's something that students mobilize around. But today we're here because a majority of the student body has mobilized around divestment from companies complicit in the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Thank you. Are there questions from other members of the committee?
Yeah, I have two questions. I'll just ask them both. One is, I'm just wondering how you came to identify these 10 in particular. That seems like a little amount. So I'm just wondering what was the process, how you came to identify the 10? That's one question. The second question is, some of what you have presented and written is really talking about the past precedents, Sudan, tobacco, fossil fuels, and South Africa, apartheid in South Africa. I'm wondering if in any of those instances you're aware of national or international consequences for divestment in any of those incidences. So were there financial, legal, economic, political consequences and movements in those instances that Brown might have been inviting if they had divested? Does that make sense to those two? Okay.
I'd be happy to answer the second question.
Okay, I can take the first. So as was outlined in the original 2020 ACRP report, that committee had outlined a set of criteria that essentially defined whether or not a company was an egregious offender. Our screening takes 3 databases and screens whether or not those companies violate 2 or more of those pre-established criteria that ACRP had done in the past. So these 10 companies were born out of being egregious offenders, so violating 2 or more of those criteria that were predetermined by ACRP in 2020.
Just that the screening databases that we have listed in this current report do research on hundreds of companies, and we're able to pool, you know, we are not as students doing the on the ground research behind kind of the direct impacts of these companies, but we're using external screening databases, which is also how, for example, with the Sudan divestment process, an external screening database procedure has been implemented as well in their divestment process. We will use that screening process to continuously assess these companies. And so we're talking about a set list of criteria and whether or not companies violate two or more of them. And so, yeah, that list can be in flux, and we're relying on research and compilations of lists of corporate or companies pulled together by these internationally recognized organizations.
I also want to answer the second question, and correct me if I misunderstood it. Divestment and boycott movements have historically set a precedent for international condemnation and international pressure against systems of immense violence, racial violence, intolerance. I think of Nelson Mandela when he actually attributed the sanctions movement and divestment movement that happened across colleges in the UK, the Western world, North America, towards the fall of the racist government in South Africa. I think something important is that we can look at Columbia University 1985, which was really almost a focal point of both anti-war movement for the throughout the Vietnam War, but more importantly, apartheid South Africa.
I think you're answering a different question than I asked. Oh, that's why let me say what I think you're at, and then go back to your answer. I'm sorry, I just don't want you to spend a lot of time when I'm asking something else. I'm asking very specifically, are you aware of any of the previous divestment actions that Brown took that you're using as a precedent of there being national and international consequences for taking the action of boycott or divestment? So in the apartheid movement, it was a national, international movement. There was resistance. There were people, I'm not aware of divestment from the Kuban brand, divestment from leading to the potential of economic sanctions, of charges, political. I'm not aware of there being concrete kinds of political and economic consequences in direct response to the action of divestment. Does that make sense? Because I understand the role of boycott and divestment as a tool. I really do. I'm just wondering, as in this moment, this issue that seems to me to be different, I'm just wondering if I'm wrong. I've just missed something. And that is, am I still not making myself clear?
I believe when we're talking about the Brown endowment of approximately $6 billion, this is not necessarily money on the geopolitical scale in the sense that, if that answers your direct question, but it is about its actions in concert with other organizations, with its peer institutions, with key political organizations of American society. And I believe, and this is scholastically contested, as many historical discussions are, but there are discussions of what was the economic impact on the state of South Africa throughout the 80s from large divestment movements. That is under discussion and contested, but definitely not ruled out as a specifically finite economic.
I think I'd also highlight what Anila had touched upon kind of like in her speech as well, which was in the case of Sudan, for example, Brown took lead, right, as a sixth university. And we are, as Frank Lick's quote had mentioned earlier, a university that our opinions are heard in the halls of Congress, they're heard in the president's office. That later led to 61 universities divesting because of the precedent that Brown set, and that also pressured Congress to pass the Sudan Accountability and Divestment Act. So I do think that there is very direct positive consequence that we've seen in terms of accountability at this national and global scale as a result of one university divesting and the proliferated actions that we see after. So I really think that when we're sitting here talking about what the true impact is that we have the capability of making here at Brown, it is very great. And it has the potential to truly proliferate at a massive scale. And that's why we have seen so much energy behind student movements and organizing, but mainly because this can lead to the actual changes that we know will directly influence and hold the Israeli government accountable to honoring and respecting Palestinian lives and making sure that we ensure the freedom of all people from the Mediterranean Liberate to the Jordan Sea, including
Israelis.
I also, sorry to continue off of my previous point, I think universities do not function in isolation. What Brown does also affects the Providence community, the state of Rhode Island, the United States, and even the world, that universities and places of higher institution like Brown, they function in a way in that what comes out of these universities do influence people's minds, decision-making, policy, that Brown itself is acting as a marker that shows a greater social change towards justice and towards improvement of people's lives, regardless of where that may be.
I'd like to ask you to follow up with us, seeing if you can tighten up this argument about the causal connection between divestment action of universities. I appreciate the point you're making about maybe it's largely symbolic, but as you said, what a university of this stature does is heard around the world. You use the phrase, it's heard in the office of the president. I'd like to ask you to follow up with us and see if you can tighten that link. I'd also like to follow up that question. It's heard in the office of the president. It's also apparently heard in the office of 24 state attorneys general, who sent a letter to the university last week informing the university that it would be on the wrong side of state legislation in at least these 24 states. There are north of 30 states that have laws on the books that have various concerns with respect to decisions to divest. Now, I understand you're on the other side of the issue, but I'm going to ask you to think for a moment about what it means to be a university and the university's role to society broadly defined, as you've cited, right? Which includes many different viewpoints, including viewpoints that maybe you disagree with. And the university has an obligation to ensure that it can still be a good citizen and engage in contracts with other states and so on. How would you have us think about that kind of problem in this situation?
I'm happy to take this one. I also have copies of letters from the National Lawyers Guild and the Muslim Legal Fund of America discussing the legal ramifications for such a divestment. And the truth is, to address the letter of the 24 attorneys general specifically, it seems to be on three levels unimplementable. So on the first level, the investments of these states into, this is specifically, if you've read the text carefully, they threaten to withdraw public pension funds holding Brown University debt in the form of bonds. And those are bundled and rather hard to extricate. It seems like on the financial logistical side, it would be difficult. And secondly, it appears to be rather deeply unconstitutional, that the NAACP versus Claiborne very carefully protects the right to political boycotts as a First Amendment speech act. Brown University acts as a person in under current corporate law. And as a speech act, it is illegal for a state to withhold public investment or withhold public funds on account of the exercise of a constitutionally protected right, such as speech. So I can forward these letters to the members of the committee as they engage with the specific legality and potency of such political threats. And then I think in the context of the untenableness of these political threats from the listed 24 politicians, I think it's really important to see these fundamentally above a legal act as a political one. It is mostly jockeying for political power within their own home states, none of which is Rhode Island, and that this is really a kind of egregious attack on the institutions and the autonomy of higher education, like Brown University. We have seen these same attorneys generals threaten higher education in their own states, and for those reasons, I believe that this attack is not only unfounded, but also a fundamental threat on Brown University's mission and goals of academic freedom.
Appreciate that response, but I'm going to push back and ask you to try again from a slightly different point of view, okay? Let's imagine you're correct, okay? Let's just grant you the argument for the moment for the purpose of talking this through, and let's imagine that the claims actually have no legal basis to them and are going to be utterly unenforceable. Let's imagine you're right. We got a letter from 24 state attorneys general, right? And one can win the legal argument at the end of the day, but still get tied up in many costly lawsuits that could cost the university a lot of money, that could jeopardize the university's reputation, and that could limit its ability to do the job that it is supposed to do, which is teach undergraduate students, prepare them for the workforce, and conduct high-quality scholarly research. Let me give you a real example here. About 20% or so of the university's annual budget comes from federal government grants to the university. Many of these grants actually flow through other states. The government will give a grant to a university, public university in some other state, and then the researchers at that state issue what's called the subaward to Brown University. That's potentially a state contract. So even if you're right, we still have to think about the possibility that even if you're right, it mires the university in a real problematic situation. And so my question, although I do appreciate your view, and I would love to have the legal opinions you've described, is how you would like the committee to think about weighing that situation when we think about our obligations to the university over the long haul.
Yeah, I think we're fundamentally getting down to rather deep questions of who does the university stand for and who makes up the university. And, you know, there's the answer that the university can cower in front of ludicrous threats from fundamentally extremist politicians. And that is a take that a university can take. That's a very safe and timid take, but it is a deep sacrifice on the principles of academic freedom that many of us are brought here by. That if we are willing to accept that not even the effect of laws, but the mere threat of lawsuit is allowed to restrict the activities of our university, we are seriously harming the product of research and that very education, which is the center of this institution, that we should be allowed to question, we should be allowed to explore new possibilities, and we should be able to do that without really unfounded and baseless threats coming from government and authorities and officials trying to silence academic voices. I think that is really antithetical to the mission of Brown University. We can think about this on so many topics. Are we willing to allow, you know, fossil fuel companies to silence climate research at Brown University? That may affect grants, but I think it is fundamentally important for a university to be a site of free inquiry and for a university to be a site of justice and global morality, and that we should look at this from the legal lens of are we protected, which, as I've stated, we are, and then the other lens, we should not be willing to cow ourselves for just the fear of risk.
Free inquiry, according to whom? What do you say to the professor who won't be able to collaborate with a researcher in Arkansas? What do you say to the PhD student who's funded by a grant that came from a university in Arkansas? What about that person's free inquiry?
Yeah, I can speak to this as a graduate worker myself. I think our referenda show that grads and students, that we understand what divestment is and that we're for divestment. We understand, and of course, this letter just came out, so not that we've had conversations on this particular point, but I think that the community is saying, now we understand better the investment profile of Brown. We're saying we don't want our wages and our work to be associated and complicit in this. We joined together in our coalition work to say that to Brown. And I think in our recent e-board election as well, who have run, you know, with a divestment campaign as well. So I think we've said in many different ways, we understand and we are for divestment. So I just wanted to say that I think the community understands. Kind of tying it back to the loss that you get, for example, from divesting from companies that may be profitable. If they change their behavior, that money comes back. Like it's not an eternal loss. And also we can be creative and find new ways to invest. So I just want to say that we think that there's a future that is wonderful for Brown, and it's a future that doesn't have to be complicit in genocide, scholasticide, and occupation of people. So I think just to kind of give the grad perspective on that.
I think it's also important to recognize that these attorney generals also have other parts of their political ideologies that may be inconsistent with what Brown does support right now. Some of them have gone against things like reproductive freedom. You could argue similar notions in terms of what happens if Brown takes a clear stance against that in terms of those people sponsoring grants and participating in these things. So I think that when you're bringing up that argument, you also have to look at their political ideologies as a whole in terms of what does that mean in exchange with this university. I'd also like to kind of ground us back in what we had, what you had brought up in the beginning, which is ACRM's charge, which is to really assess the social harm, and that it is so grave and inconsistent with the goals and principles of this university to invest its funds. I think when 24 attorney generals write a letter, you can consider these ideas of how places may be impacted, but we really encourage this deep consideration of these 10 companies we outlined, and specifically the criteria we used in terms of identifying these human rights abuses, these clear internationally defined human rights abuses, to identify these 10 companies as perpetrating social harm, to be in line with the idea that the goals and principles of this university are being directly contradicted by these companies we've presented to you in a harm so grave that in 2020 it was already deemed inconsistent with our goals and principles. So I do think, and I do hear you, and I do think that those will be considerations that are made, but specifically when we're talking about how these threats are coming at a time that could really take away from the objective nature of this board in terms of looking at that and assessing that social harm, rather than being skewed by these ideas of politicians really using Brown as a place to politically gain their campaigns in their individual home states.
Just to be clear, that's not what this would be. If the university lost the ability to engage in contracts with these other states, we're talking about taking somebody's freedom away, this university. That's what that means. Now, look, you could say that's the right thing to do, that we have to be on this side of it, but we cannot act like there's not two sides to the equation. And that is the kind of question that the committee ultimately has to grapple with.
I mean, I think there's a big question of who is taking that freedom away. That freedom is, in fact, not being taken away by ACRM, by a corporation voting to divest, by the student body in favor of divestment. That freedom is being taken away by politicians in other states who are saying that they will not engage with Brown University. The act that infringes on free inquiry is the refusal to engage with Brown University after divestment. I think that's very important to separate, because these states could equally say they refuse to, you know, engage with Brown University on so many other counts. These states might say they refuse to engage with Brown University as long as Brown University is a safe haven for queer students. Does that mean that Brown University should stop being a safe haven for queer students? No, and that would not be an infringement on free inquiry at Brown. That has to be acknowledged as these states' consistent attacks on free inquiry, which they are currently turning on Brown University, which they, of course, turned on their own institutions within their home states for years, for decades, as they've dismantled the DEI institutions, various departments at their public institutions. These are states with long histories of attacks on free inquiry. Brown is now under fire. I think every student at Brown is ready to stand with the institution in favor of free inquiry against these politicians attacking it. But I think it's very clear to separate who is the agent, who is the actor against free inquiry. It is not the committee. It is not the corporation which votes in favor of divestment. It is the state which punishes that vote.
I think it's also important to acknowledge the fact that while free inquiry is something that we care very deeply about and is something that we've also talked about prioritizing in a lot of our ways in terms of people being able to participate in these democratic demonstrations, being able to come and present to you guys as you consider this, Brown's mission is also much more than that. And we've outlined that in many ways. Our goals and values and principles are much more multidimensional than just being solely about free inquiry. We highlighted things like how the Slavery and Justice Report had established a special obligation to ensure that it does not profit from any forms of gross injustice. We highlighted the Watson Institute's mission to promote a just and peaceful world, and our university's mission as a whole to serve the community of the nation. So when you're really looking at this like multidimensional mission and these values, I think you also have to consider how that plays into this broader discussion.
Are there questions from committee members online or in the room? If not, I have another one. I'd like to talk to you about thinking through the complexity of some of these companies. So let's take GE. GE is on your list. GE also makes wind turbines that are used to generate renewable wind energy and offshore wind projects. One of the university's commitments is to get itself all the way to net zero. And it's not going to be able to do that without companies like GE making wind turbines. So when we think about an investment in a company like GE, we might look at it and say, this part of the company's portfolio, we believe contributes to social harm. This part of the portfolio over here, maybe it alleviates social harm. How do you suggest we consider that?
This is something when we've spoken with members of the investment office has also come up as a question. And our simple response then and our simple response now, and especially when addressing the committee that is specifically dedicated, not only in not considering operationalization of divestment today, but in assessing social harm, we're not asking the question of mitigating social harm right now. We are talking about proving social harm so grave it is inconsistent with our university's principles and values. So when we talk about GE, we're applying public pressure. We're asking that we divest from the percentage of its company that is contributing to the social harm. Now, as Victoria has already outlined, if this public pressure is something that our university can inspire in other peer institutions to follow suit in the context of divestment and pressure companies like General Electric to shift its manufacturing practices and production practices, then we can invest. This is a stable set of criteria, but our screening databases allow there to be flux in how these companies react to this public pressure. So right here and right now, we're asking the question of social harm. And that's clearly outlined in General Electric.
And also, I think we encourage the thinking of what does it mean to refuse to divest from a company that's perpetrating human rights violations, just as much as the question that you're asking. I'd really push back and say there is a very, very clear statement that's being made in the refusal to divest as well.
I agree. Right. Let's bring that point out. Like what you're saying is that if we're balancing some social good and some social harm, and one chooses not to divest, then one is implicitly admitting that the social good outweighs the social harm. That's what you're saying, right?
I think in some capacity, it's just the fact that we are seeing that human rights violations go in direct contradiction with our university's missions and values, mm-hmm. the ones that we pre-stated. And I think that, like we said, we are not here to discuss how divestment will actually occur. That is something that the investment office will end up going through, as it did with Sudan. They will come up with those practices. We outline these practices in response to what they had done in previous cases. We use those as guidelines. So those can be decisions that are made. This is our recommendation in that sense.
And I also just, the language that you just used was, if we choose not to divest, it is essentially investing in mitigating the social harm. We're saying that if we choose not to divest, then we are investing in this social harm. We are not positioning those two against one another. We're not discussing the mitigation of social harm within the context of net zero energy. We're discussing social harm within the context of the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the companies that we've listed that are complicit in that.
I want to be sure I understand this, because there's been a few times where you've made points, and this came through very clearly in your report, related to neutrality. And what you're getting at is the idea that, as you've expressed, there is really no such thing. One of you said something like, you know, it either does or it does not. You're on this side or you're on that side. And so just now when you responded to me, you said something like, if you invest in a company that, let's imagine we agree, causes social harm, you're saying you're invested in the social harm. And that's true, independent of any social good that might also flow out of that company. You're seeing the harm side of that equation. Have I accurately described your view?
And the harm side of that equation is the only thing that we are discussing here today when we are talking about these corporations.
Well, that's not really the only thing we have to consider, though, because the world's more complicated than that. Probably every member of the Brown University community has flown on a Boeing aircraft. And I don't think that most of us think that when we do that, I sure feel good to be causing climate change. And that's not how people look at it. They think about it as the benefit of flying on a Boeing aircraft is worth it. They know that there's carbon emissions associated with it. Some people choose to offset those emissions, some people don't. But there's a weighing that needs to take place in the context of all of the university's business and operations. It doesn't mean that the harm isn't there. It doesn't mean that one is wrong to feel that harm is the most important thing, but that there's a broader set of circumstances that have to be considered.
I just want to speak to that weighing equation. I think there are many schools, you know, on ethics and whether or not, you know, how to do that weighing balance. But I think the Brown community, grads and students have said, we've done that calculation, we've talked about it, and we're saying we don't want to be complicit in the social harm. Whether or not we have the same ideology on how we did that calculation, enough students, enough grads, enough workers, enough faculty have joined together and said, we've done that calculation and the social harm is grave. And that's what this presentation was meant to show. So I think even though maybe we won't agree exactly on the balance, I think the community has said in the referenda, in electing us, as we've said many times, that they have done that calculation and that the calculation is toward divesting because of the social harm. Yeah, so I just wanted to kind of tie it back to the stakeholders and the community itself. Yeah.
Thank you.
And if I could just add one additional piece to this, we aren't talking about that balance. And, you know, it's understandable to say that I, too, when I'm on an airline, don't feel good, you know, Boeing airline, don't feel good about contributing to climate change. But I think that when ACRM's charge is very specific in its language, and you have reiterated to us how specific the two-prong test is, and we're not talking about social harm that is so grave, it is inconsistent with the university's values and principles, but it's also doing social harm mitigation in other capacities. We're talking about social harm that is so grave. And here today, we have discussed social harm that is so grave, and we have proven that. And so we're not talking about a balance, and ACRM especially is not assessing this balance. They are assessing social harm that is so grave. And we understand from a financial perspective that there are nuances within that conversation. And we also read in the email in preparation for this presentation that we're not talking about operationalization today. We're really, really specifically focusing on the question of social harm. So I think that it's easy to get lost in that balance question, but that's not the direction that we have taken this presentation, because we are very clear on following the language that is written in ACRM's charge.
I would just offer to you that there are people who believe that the act of divestment could cause, the act of divestment could cause social harm, right? That is a view that exists within the community. So I just want to tell you that it is a way, right? I understand your view about social harm, and I do agree with you that you've outlined a clear case for social harm, not disputing that. But I'm telling you that the committee does have to engage in a kind of way. And I invite you to think about that and to continue to engage with the committee by providing information to us that might help us deliberate about that topic. Do you have questions for us? We have a few moments left. There could be questions in the room from members of the committee.
I was wondering if you could follow up on what ways divestment would perpetuate social harm as per identified in ACRM criteria.
Okay. So the question was, how could divestment perpetuate social harm? The argument that has been made by one person who submitted feedback to ACRM is that climate change would cause unimaginable social harm. And the specific example of General Electric as a company that is directly related to Brown University's net zero plans means that if your arguments are true that divestment is going to punish these corporations, then that means we would be punishing a corporation that is doing something that we believe to be aligned with our values, which is building these windmills. And so the argument goes that there could be social harm as a result of the act of divestment. Now, that's the argument that's been presented. That's not my argument to you, right? But I'm asking you to think about that kind of argument. You know, one might get into trying to calculate the size of that social harm, or, you know, how the university should weigh competing interests. Weighing competing interests is essentially the task before us. But that's what I'm asking you to speak to, and that's just one specific example. I mean,
there's alternatives to renewable energy, and within the companies identified, that is a possibility as well. While there is no alternative to companies that are absolutely helping and assisting in the perpetuation of war crimes going on in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Wanted to add, and I feel like I've made this point a few times, but I feel like it's salient to this conversation as well, that because it's indirect and we don't have that direct line of communication, it's, you know, through managers, that this is the way that we tell General Electric, we've invested, right? We like what you do
in other ways. We don't like the way that you violate these criteria. If you change this, we would love to get involved again. And that pressure could now make it so that if we are, again, invested in General Electric, now we can do in a way that is not complicit in grave social harm. So we foresee a future where these companies, no company is complicit in this way. And that this is just a tool to be able to do that. And then eventually companies that are working on other projects that the community is supportive of, then we can reinvest in such companies. So I don't think it's a future where we could never reinvest in these companies if they did not violate the criteria. So I just wanted to tie that again, because I think it is a temporary loss, but there's a bigger loss that we're here for, and that's the grave situation in Gaza. I think that that's kind of how the community, how we discuss this and really why we're here.
I think it's also important to quickly outline just the fact that you had said 96% of our endowment is actually actively invested in these portfolio funds and these funds through third-party managers. And you can invest in a portfolio that supports renewable energy, and our statement is specifically excluding General Electric. So as Abudit said, you can diversify your profile to include companies that are not perpetuating human rights abuses and still support that if Brown takes that step. And what that would pressure General Electric to do is continue its amazing work in that sense, but ensure that these very violent, egregious, as we identified, these are extremely egregious violations. If you look through our selected criteria that was proposed by the 2020 Ake Group report, we're not talking about a very small scale of harm. We're talking about a very, very massive scale of harm. And not just that, but we're saying that they violate two or more criteria of that massive scale of harm. So you're saying that General Electric should be held accountable to that. Once it changes that behavior, it can be included into the portfolio of companies that we are investing in that support that renewable energy effort. So in the sense that there is this wide portfolio of companies that do the same thing, once Brown takes that stance, and I encourage that they do, that will also put public pressure on General Electric to not be committing grave, egregious human rights violations.
It is true that one can consider the effects of divestment, for instance, you know, as you said, from a company such as General Electric, who is working to mitigate climate change. But then if one follows that logic, one could also just look at all the possible outcomes from a divestment act. And because the world is so complex, as we all know, because it's so interconnected, it'll just be a ripple effect that it'll be very hard to quantify. That is why committees such as ICRM exist. We're looking at a narrow charge of human rights violations and social harm, and we are tasked with evaluating this narrow charge. Now, of course, many different companies might have different consequences from divesting them, but we can also look at the other direction. Like, what is the, for instance, on the climate change aspect, what is the climate change consequences of continuing to be invested in these companies? For instance, the amount of environmental harm caused by, the bombing of Gaza is something that is not insignificant, and it's something that is very substantial. So we can look and get caught in the weeds of evaluating all the different equilibria that are at play, but at the end of the day, ICRM has a narrow charge of social harm, and that's what we're looking at in this specific case.
Thank you. I'd like to give you the last word this evening.
First and foremost, we're very, very appreciative that you took the time and energy to be with us today. I know this is not an easy thing to think about, to reflect on, and I think that I at least hope that through our presentation, you have seen the dedication and commitment of students on this campus on this issue. The fact that we are here, we are representing a much broader student population. We come here, whether it be via elected roles or representing specific populations or subsects of our broader community, we are here to represent all those voices. We are not individuals in any capacity. We are here in the midst of a national movement that has all reached a clear consensus that there is this grave social harm on many college campuses across the country. We do credit that national movement to the reason that we were able to even get a corporation vote in the midst of 10 years, over 10 years of organizing on this topic. This is not something that we just started talking about or thinking about during October 7th. This is something that we've been thinking about and been assessing in 2020. The fact that ACRIP was able to make this recommendation based on the information that was provided to them when this issue has only gotten so, so much bigger. The fact that we're in the midst of a genocide with over 40,000 Palestinians who have been murdered by the IDF. I think we're in a very, very specific context right now. And I encourage us to kind of root ourselves in that. And I know we keep coming back to the charge, but it was something that we really dedicated ourselves to rooting this presentation around. And we looked at the language of that charge very carefully. And we hope that throughout this presentation, you have clearly seen how we've been able to follow that charge in addressing the question of whether or not this social harm is so grave that it is a responsibility for our university to divest because of the fact that it is so separate from the goals and principles as was stated in our missions. And I think that was really, really the point that we want to drive home. And we're happy to provide extra materials, answer those extra questions. We welcome you guys to ask us those extra questions, especially the ones that came up that kind of felt that we argued were maybe not what we had prepared our presentation today specifically for in terms of in line with the charge. We're happy to have further discussion on that after.
And I did just want to add that when we initially started talking about this presentation and this meeting, something that you mentioned, Professor Kellner, was your role on this committee because of your love and dedication to this institution and your pride in its legacy. And I think that this report in particular is representative of our student love and our pride in the legacy of this institution. And I think that that is what we are bringing to this conversation and what we have as a very clearly recognized shared understanding between the committee and the students representing the broader community today. And I think that we just want to acknowledge that and share that we appreciate that and that we are doing this because of the pride that we feel Brown University as our institution.
That's very clear. Thank you.
We are out of time. But before we go, I just have to say bravo aleikum, all of you, students of Brown, for your very brave and thorough work. It takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Stan Robinson and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Steve Lowe and Mohammed Al-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC, student radio at Boston College. Thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.